On To the Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To the Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To the Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Someone on the Supreme Court who is going to be calling balls and strikes in the future based upon whatever the next president in Congress does, that strikes me as inherently biased and out of the realm. I think that's something that she should not have done, because I don't think that that shows that she intends on being impartial in the future.
House Speaker Paul Ryan had a CNN town hall Tuesday talking about Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Justice Ginsburg is catching heat this week from both sides of the aisle for calling presidential candidate Donald Trump a faker who has an ego. Trump then called Ginsburg a disgrace, tweeting, "Her mind is shot. Resign!" Exclamation point. Americans expect members of the high court to avoid wading into the political muck, but Ginsburg isn't called notorious RBG for nothing. Noah Feldman is a columnist for Bloomberg View and a law professor at Harvard. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Well, she spoke to three different media outlets about Trump, and she made pretty explicit criticisms of him, saying she couldn't even contemplate what a Trump presidency would be like for the country. And this obviously wasn't a slip of the tongue. She made three separate media appearances. Mm-hmm. Why do you think she did this now?
I think on some level, she wants to be on the right side of history. And I think on another level, she's 83, and she doesn't care what the rest of us think. She has life tenure, and that guarantees independence. And so she's free to say what she wants to say.
Right. Well, she's getting a lot of pushback, and not just from the right. The New York Times editorial page, which is not exactly right-leaning, said that Washington is more than partisan enough without the spectacle of a Supreme Court justice flinging herself into the mosh pit. Wow. What do you think of that?
That's pretty strong. I'm not sure Justice Ginsburg would be familiar with the term mosh pit, but I suppose it's impressive enough that the New York Times editorial page has heard it.
Right. Well, do you agree or not?
Look, I don't think that there's anything fundamentally wrong with a justice expressing her worldview, and that would include her political worldview when the stakes are high enough. We don't live in a world of myths. We know that the justices are human. We know that they have views. In the year 2000, in the Bush v. Gore case, the justices basically decided a presidential election. So this doesn't come as some tremendous shock. And then the real question is, you know, should the justices pretend that they don't have views? Should they keep their heads down? And there's some benefit to their doing so. They avoid this kind of controversy. But I don't think it in any fundamental way suggests that Justice Ginsburg couldn't be objective in the future or that she should step down.
There is a judicial code of conduct, though, right? And that this is a violation of it?
Well, the judicial code of conduct, in its infinite wisdom, doesn't apply to the Supreme Court justices, not even voluntarily. So they are completely on their own. They make their own judgments when it comes to ethics. Justice Robert Jackson famously said that the justices aren't final because they're infallible. They're infallible because they're final. And that definitely applies in this instance.
Let's talk about the history of this kind of outspokenness or political statements. Do justices, have they done this in the past?
It used to be much more extreme, in fact. Chief Justice John Marshall, who's probably the most important Chief Justice in the history of the United States and maybe the most important justice ever, was actually Secretary of State for John Adams and a proud member of the Federalist Party while he was Supreme Court Chief Justice. Remarkably, there's nothing in the Constitution that says that you can't serve at the same time in the executive branch and in the judiciary, even though there is a rule that says you can't serve in Congress in the executive branch at the same time. So this is small potatoes compared to what our history reveals.
And you have recent political relationships, like Justice Scalia going on a hunting trip with Dick Cheney and not recusing himself in a case that then involved Vice President Dick Cheney.
Yeah, that led to Justice Scalia's very famous solo opinion where he said that he was never in the same blind as Dick Cheney when he was hunting, which I think is one of the greatest and most humorous things in the history of the Supreme Court. You know, Justice Ginsburg and Justice Scalia had a friendship, And I can just imagine her thinking, you know, if Nino can hunt, I can say what I think to a reporter. I think they shared a certain, contempt would be too strong a word, but a certain sense of independence that doesn't make them subordinate to what conventional wisdom tells them.
But what does this say in the larger context about how we should view the court? And we perhaps ill-advisedly have wanted to see the court as impartial and just letting, you know, their opinions, their judicial opinions guide what they say and do and not political opinions.
Well, I don't know. Let me push back a little bit. Do you really know anybody who thinks that the justices, when the chips are down, don't have political, moral, and legal views that they follow? I mean, lots of the cases the Supreme Court decides have no political consequences of any visible type. And in those, it doesn't matter what the justices' individual views are very much, and the justices usually agree on those cases. But in the hot-button cases, the ones that you hear about on the radio or you read about in the newspaper, the ones that really matter, especially that have to do with the Constitution, we all know that the justices have allegiances and have morals and have values. And that's why so many important cases come out 5-4, at least they do when we have nine justices on the court, because there are real disagreements on those questions among the justices. And I think the public gets that, and I think it's fine for the public to realize that. So in my view, you know, Justice Ginsburg's comments shouldn't undercut respect that we have for the court, because they don't tell us anything we didn't already know that we didn't learn in the Bush v. Gore case.
So how far should they go? Could they actually go out and campaign for a political candidate?
Well, nothing in the Constitution prohibits it, although I think it would probably be in pretty poor taste to do so. But look, I mean, Justice Ginsburg came pretty close to that here, didn't she? I mean,
yeah.
She's sending a message to people who take her view seriously. And my guess is that it might motivate a few people to vote. And my other guess is that it won't cost any votes to Hillary Clinton on the other side.
Yeah. Well, what about this idea that should there be a case involving Donald Trump before her in the future, she might have to recuse herself?
Well, if it involved Donald Trump personally, if it were sort of a replay of the Bush v. Gore case where his personal interests were at stake in front of the court, you know, I'm sure his lawyers would say that she should recuse herself and it would be up to her. But I think there would be a credible argument that she should, because she did attack him personally. You know, she said he was a faker. She said that her late and much beloved husband would have said jokingly that they should move to New Zealand if Trump was elected. On the other hand, if Trump became president and the issues before the court were issues involving the executive branch, I don't think she should have to recuse herself, because those would be cases about the law and about executive action. They would not be cases about Trump personally.
So I guess just in a larger scope, looking at Ruth Bader Ginsburg, she seems, as we said earlier, that, you know, she's not shy of taking controversial positions, and she's not shy to be outspoken. If she thinks that Donald Trump, and perhaps a Republican, is a great threat to the future of the country, why didn't she step down earlier in the Obama presidency so that he could appoint someone like her to fill her seat?
You know, that's a great question. I am not alone in thinking that actually Justice Ginsburg should have stepped down at some point during President Obama's term. She's 83, and I hope that she lives a long life. She's a wonderful person. But she's been sick in the past, and I think she's playing dice a little bit, you know, taking a chance with the future of the Supreme Court by having remained on the bench. She may feel now that it would really be a disaster if Trump were elected and she had to step down in the next 4 years, and that may partly have motivated her actions, but she could have done something about that, and she chose not to. So that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, you're saying the right side of history. I wonder if she's looking at this, and she hasn't said this. I'm just wondering if she's looking at this through a Jewish lens and looking at this historically.
I have no idea. You know, Justice Ginsburg in her public speeches occasionally will talk about her Jewish values. When she does, they typically are reasonable, pleasant values of a very abstract type. Justice, social good, you know, things that you could agree with because you're Jewish, or you could agree with them if you're not Jewish in any way, shape, or form, you'd still find those values equally valuable, I suspect. So, you know, my instinct is that that's probably not what's driving her here. I think she's probably speaking as an American liberal more than as an American Jewish liberal.
Mm.
You know, when it comes to human motivations, Justice Ginsburg is harder to read than most. Her public pronouncements tend to be pretty opaque, and in the past, they've actually been pretty general and nonspecific. And so It's a very, very interesting question as to why she chose to do this, but it's not one to which we have an apparent or an easy answer right now.
Noah Feldman, he's a professor of law at Harvard Law School and a columnist for Bloomberg View. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think Supreme Court justices like Ruth Bader Ginsburg should keep their political views to themselves? Leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, how to pay for homeless services. LA County supervisors decide a tax on pot is a good idea. If we vote to legalize pot, that is. That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. LA County supervisors are hoping you'll vote yes to legalizing weed and then yes to taxing it when you go to the polls this November. They hope to use that tax money to pay for homeless services. It's a roundabout way to round up the cash. Other ideas like a millionaire's tax and a sales tax have fizzled. Here to talk about that and another ballot proposal to build housing for the homeless is Fernando Guerra, professor of political science and the director of the Center of the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount. Welcome back.
Thanks, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Well, let's talk about this taxing idea. Yesterday, the Board of Supervisors voted to put this initiative on the ballot. It would be a 10% tax on marijuana businesses. So how would that work?
So if pot is legalized and there's an initiative statewide, then the selling of that would be taxed just like many other products, but at 10%. That money would then go for the county, and the county could use it for social services. One of the challenges is that you have different entities who are only allowed to do certain things, but together, meaning the city and the county, are trying to meet the challenge of homelessness. The city is basically not allowed to spend their bond money on social services, and there's been a consensus emerging that there has to be a comprehensive effort, meaning not only housing, but housing that includes all kinds of services. That if you only provide housing, that won't do it. If you only provide the services, that won't do it. You need to combine the two.
Mm-hmm.
The city cannot do that with its money.
And what you're referring to is the other proposal that's on the ballot, this bond proposal that would raise money to build housing, and that's a city proposal. So there are two homeless proposals that'll be on the ballot in November.
That's correct.
All right. So why did they go the pot route, the supervisors? Why didn't they go with the sales tax route, for example?
Well, I think it's just like the sin tax that we do on, cigarettes and alcohol. It's always easy to pick on those. And we have historically had a taxing ability to go after those. And they're just putting that in marijuana in that category, along with alcohol, with, and those type of products. It's just easier. And I think that many people who support the legalization of pot, many of them will just think of this as part of it and will go ahead and support that. And then even those who may vote against the legalization of pot will say, well, if we're going to legalize it, I certainly want it taxed. It's just easier to get the votes that are required from a political perspective.
And it needs a two-thirds support, right?
Correct, yes.
So that's a pretty high bar.
Yeah. And this is in the context of a very long ballot that is not going to only include everybody who's running for public office, from president, down to some local school district or city council offices, but a ton of initiatives on the state ballot and a countywide sales tax for the MTA. And so by the time, people are going to be faced with billions of dollars that we're going to be voting on. And so that could create a difficulty when there's a fatigue, not only on the number of initiatives, but the number of tax initiatives.
Right. And then could there be some unintended consequences, such as when there's a tax, not encouraging black marketers to enter the legal market? Because they would think, well, why would I want to do that and pay an extra 10%?
Yeah, and we have no idea how that market, both as it gets legalized, how that will work out. Colorado obviously offers some examples, but there is no sense. So absolutely there is a black market could develop. But in fact, there is a black market right now for the selling and purchasing of marijuana right now. But how it would morph given this new regulatory environment, it's anybody's guess because we've never really dealt with this.
Okay, let's talk about the bond measure a bit more. What is it? Let's break that down. So it's only, as we said, it's only to build housing, and then the city becomes a big developer building a bunch of supportive and low-income housing?
Yes, yes. So the city will then be the builder of housing, which means they're going to have to buy land and then build and then hire firms to build this, just like the MTA builds rail, just like the LAX builds the runways and the airports and the terminal. The city has that ability. Now, one of the major challenges is, of course, in this era of high property values, that a lot of the money would go for that. I'm of the opinion that the city is actually already one of the largest landowners within the city of Los Angeles, actually even outside the city. They're one of the biggest landowners in the Eastern Sierra or over in the Vegas area regarding Hoover Dam, et cetera. So the city's a big landowner already. They can take much of the existing land and try to build on that land. Now, it may not be in the perfect location, but there's going to be some bargaining and negotiating about that. I'm of the opinion, for instance, we take the old Parker Center and knock it down, even though some people think it's worth saving for historic reasons. I'm not of that opinion, but I would say knock that down and build right there, and there you save yourself the value of the land. But it's really about purchasing land and construction housing. Once you do that, though, the city cannot provide services. That's the county's role, and that's where that second initiative comes in.
Right. So would there be a problem if one initiative was voted in and another was not?
Yes and no. For instance, if the city has its initiative and they go ahead and start that process, there'll be enough of a lag time for the county to still be able to use some of the current resources and have to rearrange how they go about doing that. It'll be difficult, but it's doable. On the other hand, if the pot tax passes, but the housing doesn't, they can use that that tax for all kinds of other services, mental services, rehab services, etc. So that money will not in any way go to waste. It will still be applied for what it was intended to, just not at the housing being built by the city.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
That's Fernando Guerra. He's the professor of political science and director of the Center for the Study of Los Angeles at Loyola Marymount University. Well, developers are also using the ballot initiative process to get things done. Here's how it works. Let's say you're a developer and you want to build a big box store or a shopping mall. You could go through the planning process, which would take years, or you could put your idea before the voters as a ballot initiative. Only before it gets to the ballot, because of a loophole, it could actually get fast-tracked by city officials and never make it to the voters. Pioneered by Walmart, that's what's happening here in California. And here to tell us more is Ian Lovett, who reports from LA for The New York Times. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline.
Okay, first, why are developers trying to do it this way, to get their projects on the ballot?
So the idea for developers here is really to use the ballot measure to circumvent California's environmental review process. We have a law called the California Environmental Quality Act, which is known as CEQA, and it allows almost anyone to sue a proposed development if they think it's going to have an impact on the environment. And that impact could be anything from destroying animal habitats or befouling the air to even just blocking a view. And so developers have complained for decades that this slows the process down far too much. And with the ballot process, they found a way basically to circumvent this law, because if something is approved via ballot measure, then it's exempt from CEQA. And so that's why this appealed to developers, and we're seeing it more and more.
Why is it exempt from CEQA if it's on the ballot?
So that's just the way the law works. The ballot initiative process was designed to let the voters kind of weigh in over and above what the legislature decides, and it was supposed to be a check on them. And a lot of people think this is now sort of a perversion of the way the direct democracy system was supposed to work, but that was the way it was set up.
But there's a twist, because then the city officials could say, oh, look, you have enough signatures to get on the ballot. We'll just approve your project before it needs to be voted on.
Yes, that's exactly right. And very often the public doesn't actually get to vote on the project, because once 15% of voters have signed a petition saying they want to put the project on the ballot, then it goes to the local city council and they have a choice. They can either call a special election or they can just approve the project outright. And in a lot of cases, special elections would cost hundreds of thousands or even millions of dollars. And so particularly in smaller cities, the elected officials don't want to pay for that. They're worried about their budgets, and so they just approve the project outright. And in those cases, the public doesn't actually get to vote, and it's really just a very small portion of the electorate making the decision.
How many projects have been approved this way?
So it's really impossible to tell, because there's no state agency that tracks this. Walmart has really pioneered this strategy, and over the last 6 or 7 years, they have done this in at least 9 different cities to get proposed stores approved. In all but one of those cases, the local city council just approved the measure without holding a public vote.
Hmm. Well, I guess opponents could put their own ballot initiative together that would oppose the project?
They can, yes. And some local communities have tried to fight back when developers put their projects on the ballot. But it's very difficult, because they almost never have as much money to put into the fight as the developers do. So in Carlsbad, for example, which is a wealthy and very educated community north of San Diego, opponents of a shopping center that was approved using the ballot process there were able to gather signatures of their own. They forced a referendum, and voters actually shot the project down. But stories like that are very, very rare. Because in most cases, even when there is a special election, the developer has much more money to spend on the campaign. And most voters are not familiar enough with the planning process to know exactly what the choice is. They just sort of see, oh, there's a proposal to put a new Walmart. I want a new Walmart. That sounds great. And they don't realize that in the normal planning process, there's often a negotiation where the city council will ask for concessions, like Walmart to pay for wider streets to accommodate traffic that it's going to bring, or to pay for extra policing, which will be required once all the people are flocking there. And so you know, that's another reason why developers are starting to use this more and more often.
Well, the other thing is even if you sign a petition to get something on the ballot, it doesn't mean you necessarily support it. It just means that you might just want to see it on the ballot.
Yes, that's exactly right. And that's one of the arguments opponents of this have used. In Moreno Valley, for example, the city council voted to approve a huge warehouse project after the signatures had been gathered without holding a vote. And thousands of people who had signed those petitions later sort of said, oh, I didn't understand what I was signing. I thought we were just going to have a vote and try to kind of undo their signatures, which is possible.
So the Moreno Valley project you're talking about, this would build the largest warehouse complex in the United States, from what I understand?
Yes, yes.
And environmental groups sued?
Environmental groups sued a number of times, saying that it was going to hugely increase truck and car trips to the area and add to air pollution. The developer then pulled the project out of the planning process, gathered signatures, put it on the ballot, and then the local city council approved it without actually holding a vote. So that saved the developer not only time finishing the planning process, but also saved them from having to go to court to fight these lawsuits.
But then there were these accusations that the developer had bought some of the council members because of all the campaign contributions. And how has that gone over then locally?
There has been a huge brouhaha over this locally going back a number of years. It's been a very controversial project. And there have been more lawsuits about exactly the way that this one was approved. But it looks like, for the moment at least, that it's going to be allowed to go forward.
Well, what about just closing this loophole and letting it actually go before the voters?
Yeah, so this has started to become a more common strategy developers are using. 2 years ago, when the California Supreme Court ruled that even when the city council approves the project outright without holding a special election, that if it has gone through the ballot process and gathered signatures, that it's still exempt from CEQA. And so a lot of lawyers who work on this type of stuff say that it's only going to become more and more common and a bigger problem unless the state legislature changes the law so that those projects won't be exempt in such cases. But so far, it hasn't really showed up on the radar of state legislatures, and there's not any major movement to change this law.
Well, all of this is coming about because a lot of people hate CEQA. They see it as unnecessarily burdensome for developers. Even the governor is critical of it. So is there any attempt at all to make CEQA more streamlined?
Yeah, Jerry Brown has been critical of CEQA on a number of occasions, and there have been a number of efforts to try to reform CEQA in a holistic way. But at the moment, there's not a big push on that, and in the past, those efforts have not been successful. It is a much hated law among developers, but environmentalists credit it for really helping preserve open spaces in California and improve air quality and all sorts of other environmental benefits. So they've been really hesitant to make any major changes to it.
But this is a law that isn't overseen by anyone in particular. It's just used for lawsuits, correct?
Well, it's enforced by lawsuit.
Enforced,
there's not
yeah.
a state agency that's responsible for enforcing it. It's enforced by people who see a proposed development, say, for example, I think this is going to make air quality in the area worse, and then they sue, and then that gets investigated. And in some cases, they reach a settlement with the developer and drop the suit, or in some cases, it goes all the way to a judge who has to make a decision.
So you can see how that would set up years of litigation. The set up that way.
Yes, the reason developers are so critical of it is that in some cases projects will get sued a dozen times or even more, and the project will end up going forward exactly as it was. But in the meantime, they've been held up 10 years and not able to build it and spent millions of dollars on lawyers and all sorts of other costs. And so that's why they've been trying to find a way around it and have increasingly settled on going to the ballot.
Ian Lovett, reporter in LA for The New York Times. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Mel.
Coming up, a new documentary about a legendary LA nightclub.
It was, as we're saying, a safe haven, and a safe haven to be gay, to be out, black, and proud.
We'll talk about Jules Catch One next on Press Play.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Gay marriage is legal across the country. Gays and lesbians serve openly in the armed forces. There's an Emmy-winning TV show about a transgender woman. It is easy to forget the battles that were fought to bring about that change. One of the front lines in Los Angeles was Jules Catch One, a nightclub near the corner of Pico and Crenshaw in South L.A. For more than 40 years, it was a haven for gays and lesbians, especially African Americans. In 1973, Catch One opened. It was the creation of an African American woman named Jewel Thais Williams. A new documentary about Jewel's Catch One and its proprietor is being screened at Outfest this year.
Her club became full of different colors.
There was still an abundance of racism.
You were denied admission. Not because you weren't 21, because you were black, because you were brown, because you were a woman. You could come to Catch One and find all of those people here having a party.
Catch was created to fulfill a need.
She broke down that racial barrier. At the same time, she's trying to run one of the biggest clubs in the country.
C. Fitz is the director of the film. She's in the studio with me now. Hi.
Hello. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming. And Jewel Thais Williams is also with me via the phone. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for inviting us.
Great to have you. Well, you began the club in 1973. What did you see then was the need you needed to fill?
Well, at the time, it was just for African-American people to be able to drink at the neighborhood bar. That's how small it was when we started. Mm-hmm. And then eventually, gays and lesbians, my friends, and others started coming to the club, and it kind of evolved into being a gay and lesbian nightclub after that.
And Fitz, 1973, a lot of people were in the closet back then, especially African-Americans.
Yeah. Yeah, they didn't have a place to go. And even the West Hollywood gay bars for black and female asked for multiple IDs. I mean, they just didn't, they couldn't get in. And Jewel's Catch One was one of the few places that allowed them in with one ID, of course. And it became known as that, a place that everybody was welcome.
But your club was raided fairly frequently.
Well, raided might not be the word. Let's just say that they came in. There was nothing going on. They couldn't ever close us down for anything because we weren't doing anything wrong. But they would walk through under the pretext of looking for someone, some things, you know, different people that they were trying to search out. But, you know, I knew that they knew that we ran as clean of a ship as possible, considering the size of the crowds and the variety of the crowds that came there.
I mean, the people in the club and Jewel were definitely harassed. They did come in rifles drawn. They did come in, park their cars right outside and kept their lights going, even though they never found much or could raid. They did threaten the folks there to expose them to their jobs, to their families. And so they did everything they could to keep trying to shut her down. And she kept standing up and opening the doors. And that's what's pretty amazing. But police harassment, she went through on a weekly basis.
Yeah.
What was the pretext? Why would they say that they were there?
They came in, oh, we saw somebody that had on a white T-shirt. Okay, you know, maybe 50 or 60 people there had on white T-shirts. And we saw them entering the club, and we want to go in, and we're coming in to see if we can find them. So they would go around flashing flashlights in people's faces and just generally making their presence known in an effort to shut us down, keep people from coming. I think it was at the basis of all of that.
When your club became known as a gay and lesbian nightclub, what was the reaction in the community, in your neighborhood?
Well, we weren't thrown out the red carpet, to say the least. At first, neighbors would call complaining about noise and things like that. But eventually, the comments and not speaking to me and those kinds of things died down somewhat. But, you know, homophobia doesn't go away overnight. And it didn't, you know, with me. They just pretty much tolerated me, I'm sure, at first, until they got a chance to know me, and then they kind of lighten up a little bit.
Right. And Fitz, when you were doing interviews with patrons of the nightclub, how did they, would they go in secrecy? Would they not tell their family and friends that they were going to this club?
Yeah, a lot of them. The club, there's a woman in the documentary, her name is Libby, and she not only thanks Jewel, but the club itself for helping her come out. Because it was within those walls that they saw people that looked like them, that acted like them, or they could be themselves, gave them a space to flirt, to catch one or more, as Jewel named the place. And it was, as we're saying, a safe haven, and a safe haven to be gay, to be out, black, and proud. And there weren't any places at a certain time for that at all. And especially when the AIDS crisis hit, it became a different type of a safe haven, where Jewel was a caretaker to many, where she turned the parking lot into a soup kitchen and she offered them food, where her happy hour was actually at times one of the only meals that they got. I mean, they were shunned from their families, friends, communities, and Catch One became the only place that they could go to get any kind of help or comfort or love. And Jewel was at the tippity top of that.
So how did you run a nightclub and also run basically an AIDS hospice center at the same time?
The hospice center was not, it was Rue's house, and that's my spouse, and together we opened it, but she was the person that managed and operated it, that and it was a shelter for women and children with the AIDS. And what we did was we kept the moms and their children together, whereas it was customary prior to that to take the kids into the foster care system and separate them from their moms.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Jewel Thais Williams. She was the proprietor of Jewel's Catch One for more than 40 years, and she is still executive director of the Village Health Foundation. And also joining me in the studio, C. Fitz, the director of a new documentary about Jewel and her club that is screening at Outfest. And this club, it came into being, Fitz, in the 70s during the sexual revolution, the disco era. Can you talk about some of, you have several disco queens.
I do, yeah.
In your movie.
The music's really important. And gosh, it ran the gamut of disco and Evelyn Champagne King, for instance, who's in our film, and her hit Shame. That was very important at the time to the folks there. They were shamed from their families and communities, and that was a hit back then, and it really resonated in the club. And she performed there, as well as Thelma Houston, who is in our film as well, and Bonnie Pointer and Thea Austin. And for instance, Thelma Houston used to dance at Catch before she became famous. And that's pretty neat that she has that kind of history. She heard Don't Leave Me This Way for the very first time at Catch in an empty club. Jewel allowed her to play it. She wanted to hear it before even Motown heard it.
And that's before it was a hit.
Before it was a hit, yeah. And they went to the Catch one afternoon. Jewel allowed them to put it on so they could hear it in a club. Thelma really wanted to hear it in a club. And, you know, cut to, she wins a Grammy. So there's so much history. And a lot of people went through there. Sharon Stone is in our film. She used to dance there. She also donated her time to help with Rue's House, the shelter for women with AIDS and their children. And CCH Pounder, our narrator, also went to the club. And there's just a lot of history.
Madonna.
There. Madonna. Oh, Madonna. She gave a big party in 2000 for her music album. And that was a gigantic party, as you can imagine. Red carpet. And she had been frequenting the club often. There's a lot of patrons that have some great memories. Even one fellow that got stepped on by Madonna as
literally
a souvenir. Yeah, it was great.
Jewel, what was it like to see your club that started as this, you know, neighborhood watering hole turned into this place where superstars would hang out?
I'm still not sure how any of that happened, you know, but it did. And we were known all over the world at its peak time because of the celebrities and because of everybody being welcome there. Folks would come from, like I said, every country, from France, from England, call from the airport. I need to tell the cab driver how to get me there. Is it okay? Can I find a place to check my luggage? You know, as well as locals from New York. And when Madonna was frequenting the club on a regular basis, then folks would drive down from, like, San Francisco, Oakland, Northern California, up from San Diego, Arizona, and that, just to get a glimpse of her if she showed up that particular night.
But were you ever worried that that would alienate your regulars?
I wasn't worried about it, and it did happen that at one time they became alienated, but it had already started them prior to this big explosion of celebrities, because the West Hollywood clubs started lowering the requirements for folks to come in. And at the same time, Madonna and other stars started coming. So this brought in a predominantly white patronage. And when the black folks realized that that was happening, then they wanted to blame me for it.
So your patrons started going to West Hollywood bars and nightclubs because they started allowing in African-Americans? They weren't allowing in African-Americans?
Yes. Yes. They lowered the bar for and requirements for them and needed them because it was a lot of competition going on, you know, at that time. So they needed, in order to stay open, they had to do what they needed to do, and that was to start allowing blacks to come in as well as more women to come into their clubs then.
So you went through so much with this club, with the police coming to try to harass you. You were the victim of arson at one point. You had all sorts of other battles, and you survived. And then last summer, you finally closed and decided to sell.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, one more time, the scene had changed. But more than that, the number of men that were lost that died during the AIDS crisis created a big gap. And we had more competition and not enough to go around. And then I was tired, too.
Yeah.
42 years and 75 years old, 76 years old. Yeah. And,
it's a long time to be clubbing.
Yeah, I had plenty of time and plenty of fun to party. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's Jewel Tice Williams, the proprietor of Jewel's Catch One for more than four decades. She's still the executive director of the Village Health Foundation. And C. Fitz, the director of a new documentary about Jewel and her club. And there's a screening of the movie at Outfest this Sunday, the 17th, at 11 a.m. in Hollywood. And you can get tickets at outfest.org. On this program, why say haricot vert when you can say green beans? That and other menu items one restaurant critic finds extremely annoying. We'll get his other pet peeves next on Press Play.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and Tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Los Angeles dining scene is getting a bit precious, and here to help us explain is a sketch from Portlandia.
If you have any questions about the menu, please let me know.
I guess I do have a question about the chicken, if you could just tell us a little bit more about it.
The chicken is a heritage breed, woodland-raised chicken that's been fed a diet of sheep's milk, soy, and hazelnuts.
Okay, this is local?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm going to ask you just one more time, and it's local?
It is.
The hazelnuts, these are local?
How big is the area where the chickens are able to roam free?
I'm sorry to interrupt. I have exactly the same question.
4 acres.
Okay, transport that scene to Abbot Kinney, and it would fit right in. But food writer Josh Scherer is taking a stand. He's the associate dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine. He's come up with a list of the most annoying words and phrases on menus. Welcome back, Josh.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, so the upscale dining experience in LA right now, you can feel a little bit shamed when you read the menu. Why did you compile this list?
I think that's exactly why I did, because it's so many times when you go out to eat, there are like words on the menu that are supposed to like make you feel less important than the restaurant, if that makes sense.
Uh-huh.
So it's like you read like, you know, something kind of nonsensical where it'll be like vanilla sphere and cardamom soil, and you're like, I don't even know what that is.
Does
like,
that
I
really don't... exist?
That is a
cardamom soil.
That is an actual. I think it was. I love ink. Love everything Michael Voltaggio does. But that was an actual dessert on the menu: vanilla sphere, cardamom soil, burntwood sabayon. And I was so confused. Even when I ate it, I was like, "What? What is soy? Is this granola? Like, I don't understand. It looks like a diorama from like you know a sixth grade science project in kind of a cool way. But at the same time, it's like you know, it's it could have just said ice cream, you know, granola." Maybe thrown in the word artisanal somewhere in there. Too.
But that's a word that you don't like.
No, it's I don't like it either. Not in particular. Not in particular.
What about this idea that you have to know the farm where your meat came from?
So I was a little bit torn on that because I appreciate farmers and I appreciate everyone in the restaurant industry that, you know, works to make sure local food is on my plate. That's an ostensibly good thing that we should be rooting for. But like. At some point when the same farm gets name dropped over and over, it kind of loses, you know, its sort of power. Like people are still name dropping Nyman Ranch, for instance, which is up in the Bay Area. You'll still see Nyman Ranch pork chops on menus, even though founder Bill Nyman left the company like 10 years ago because it became something that he hated. And like Chipotle is using Nyman Ranch pork. And so for you to like go to a fine dining restaurant and see a $38 Nyman Ranch pork chop, it's like if Chipotle is above putting this farm on their menu, like maybe you should take a step back.
Well, why are they doing this? Presumably because it justifies higher prices. Is that one reason?
I think that's exactly what it is. And I mean, there are a ton of factors. I mean, even, you know, restaurants are closing so fast. Labor costs are rising. And so I guess like the cheapest way to be able to up the value is just throwing adjectives in front of words, which like you got to give some props on that, at least. Like, they figured out a system, and it seems to be working to some extent. But I think we can also call it out.
One that you call out is how they present the cheese.
They do present that. They curate the cheese.
They don't present it. They curate it.
Is the verb that they are actually doing. They're not giving you cheese. You might not even be eating it. But it is curated.
A curated cheese
from
plate.
Their own. It's a hand-selected, curated, artisanal cheese plate. And it's so similar to a cheese plate where you assume that someone, by putting cheeses on a plate, has already done a certain sense of curation. You know,
A.K.A.
That's,
choosing.
A.K.A. choosing, exactly. But curated, it's, I mean, so many syllables and it just sounds so fancy. Like someone is there to, you know, personally hand-select each of these cheeses for you.
Yeah, and I think it sounds like there's a curator.
There's a curator, like yeah. In a museum. They have a museum of cheeses that they are curating specifically for you, when in actuality it's just, you know, whatever cheeses they happen to have.
Another one of your pet peeves is the small plate phenomenon.
Yeah, that is tough. I think the problem is that small plates also goes by the name share plates, also goes by the name family style, and those are like three mutually exclusive things. Like you hear family style and you think like, oh, this is a large thing for me, an entire family, to like a Domino's pizza is a family style
or
dish,
like
to
a
me.
Big plate of spaghetti meatballs,
exactly, like Buca di Beppo style. That like Buca di Beppo yeah. is the last family style restaurant on earth, and then you go get like a family style farro salad and it's, you know, three spoonfuls and you have four people and you don't know what to do, so that one's a little tough to swallow. And I think it just used to be called tapas, right?
Yeah.
Tapas was the word that we
used to do that in the
circa
90s.
Like yeah, yeah. Now it's 99 to 04.
Shared plates, small plates, family style.
Yeah, it keeps you guessing though, which is fun. You're always kind of intellectually stimulated in that way.
They like, never say large plates. Well, medium sized plates.
They've started to use large plates will be called large format.
Oh.
The entire format is large, as well as the plate, but mainly the format. And so if it's like, you know, a 3-pound. Giant tomahawk steak or whatever, that is not a large plate. That's not family style either. It's a large format entree. And now restaurants have started adding whole animals to their menu, which is going to throw just everyone
whole
for a
animals?
Loop. If you go to like the Cannibal in Culver City, they're doing now whole animal presentations, and that's going to get wild, and I'm excited for it.
Wow, I'm excited for
the
it.
Adjectives
there's no
you can
plate
throw
large
in.
Enough for that
no,
one.
No, there's not.
What about this idea of foraging? Menu items, foraged menu items.
Foraged menu items. So, I mean, I remember Alma, which was in the Arts District, got a ton of accolades. They were one of the first restaurants in LA to have like a permanent forager. And like that's really cool if you can sustain that.
As opposed to a curator.
They're kind of like a wild curator. It's a whole thing. But I mean it's this kind of thing that grew from, you know, when Noma in Denmark kind of blew up and they were doing all this wild foraging. And, you know, in Denmark you're in this like unarable environment where someone's like ripping sea lettuce, you know, out of like a lake that's half frozen. And then in LA, we have, you know, literally the best farmers markets in the world. Chefs from New York are pining to get their produce from LA. And we're like, nah, we're gonna head down to the ocean and see what we can grab out of the sand.
Also, foraging in downtown LA.
Foraging, there are a couple, like, there are some urban foraging expeditions. Ooh. That you can go on. You can pay to be led around and see which weeds. There's actually an app being developed. I can't remember what it's called, but where you can see which edible plants are around you. It's kind of like if Siri and the Boy Scouts were one.
Wow, edible legal plants, I hope.
Yes.
Anyway, the number one item on your list is menu substitutions politely declined.
So I had a personal crisis about this because I recognize that it is incredibly annoying and pretentious, but I'm also 100% for it. And I recognize myself as being annoying and terrible for that. But I think that is... If you are, you know, a chef who is trying to put together something that is like from your own, you know, personal, like you're trying to put yourself on a plate, you're, you know, putting your artistry there. And artistry is another word that could be on a list like that. But I mean, I think you should try and like enjoy it how they're intending it to be enjoyed. At the same time, I hate myself for saying that because it's just freaking food that you're paying for.
Also, politely declined.
Politely, yeah. Well, I appreciate that. You know, I don't want them
to
just be
passive aggressive.
Brusquely, you know, but I can see that. I don't want my menu to be passive aggressive at me. You know, I want the menu to remain somewhat neutral in that sense.
Artisanally crafted neutrality.
Yes.
Josh Scherer, Associate Dine Editor for Los Angeles Magazine. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks so much.
Right. Julie Myers has the carefully curated listener comments.
First, a point of order. Foraging downtown is just dumpster diving, so perhaps we should avoid that. Of course, everyone has menu pet peeves, and they wanted to share them on Facebook today. Patricia Martinez complains about gluten-free. Gluten-free anything, even if it is, but there's a lot of menu items that were always gluten-free, like Haricot Vert, for instance. They never had any gluten
in the
beginning.
I don't know what
the
French is for that, but that should be on there.
Gluten-free. You know it. I speak French.
Yeah, I don't know the gluten-free.
Gluten.
Listeners, weigh in on that.
Charlie Carter on Facebook says that if the dish is deconstructed, then substitutions should be a breeze because all you have to do is move something around on the plate. Anita Ann Rios Sherman says that anything called rustic is completely skipped over 100% of the time. She will not do it. When we start to see something called urban, I think that we have a problem.
Absolutely. All right. We want to hear your pet peeves. At KCW Press Play is our Twitter and also our Facebook. Julie Myers, thank you very much. And I'm Madeline Brand. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.